And we've seen the mountains of Syria. That's where we're doing our most of our fighting there. When it was all over and we came back, our destination was Java. Well, we landed Java, and that's where things
with the Japanese firing from tops of trees. The devil friends, you can always see your enemy. Or sometime. But in the jungle, it's a totally different aspect of life. You don't see them, you can practically walk past them.
And then, as whoever squeezed that trigger first, he is the one who's standing. But they chased us all over Java. And last we were caught. And we were taken in. We met up with some of our mates. And they threw us in a cage. We were left there for days. I don't know exactly how long. But we never got any water. In this cage there was Javanese, Ambanese, and when they brought us out, there was only the few Australians that really came out. All the others were dead. Then they took us for interrogation. As we were walking through the door, we heard the screams of animals. My mate said to me, "It's terrible, they must be torturing dogs." So we went in, we were sat down on a seat, tied tightly round the arms to the side of the chair, and a rope tied round your feet. It's brought up tightly and tied around your throat. And then to add to the discomfort, they put a cord around your head. This cord consists of a loop on one end and a peg on the other. They put the peg through the loop and they just keep twisting the peg. It's placed on your head and it just keeps creaking and groaning until eventually it cracks. You pass out, you're brought back to life. They're asking the same old questions. The defence positions all around Australia. We told them that we hadn't been out of our own backyard. It being that in Japan, it wasn't a thousand of our land. And people that knew everything that went around must have been very good. Because you wouldn't know what went round the other fellow's backyard. So, after days of this torture, we were taken out one day to stretch our legs. And two of the Japs that was with me took me past this place. When they opened the door for us to go out, we could hear the screams. And I thought, this is the dogs they're torturing. Until I seen that actually it was human beings. The place was like an amphitheatre. Tiers and tiers of seats, and all the Japanese sitting there screaming and laughing while these men were getting beheaded and torn to bits. Well, I thought after I'd seen a few, this must be my turn. For the two of the Japs grabbed me, but they just turned me around. And they took me back to where I came from. I stuck back up on the seat, the rope tied tightly around your feet, and brought up the back and round your throat. Then the old cord around your head, and it started, and away she went. They ask the same old questions, and you're told the same answers. You didn't know a thing. This went on for quite a while, until one day they took us away. We were taken to a camp. For the first time, we could see Australians, English, and I don't mind admitting, when we looked through a fence, we seen an enormous giant. His name was Ronald Ramsey Ray. Well, we firstly thought he was one of these stand-over men, because there were people standing there looking through the fence. But no one attempted to go in, so my mate said, well, we must go in and rough him up a bit. So we crawled through the fence, and my mate picked up his towel, and he tore it in half. He gave me a half, and I sent his soap, and I broke that in half. So we both had half a towel and half a cake of soap each, the first time we'd seen it for months. And he washed the soap from his head and body and looked for his towel. And I handed him mine, my half, and said, dry yourself on this. And he dried himself and thanked me and handed it back. He looked around and he said, my towel's gone. And I said, mate, that's half of it you just dried yourself on. So he laughed and said, well, Aussies, I'm an Aussie too. My name is Ronald Ramsey Ray, and I'm a group captain. I said, oh, I'm sorry, mate. I thought you were something else. And he just laughed and walked away, and we had our share. Then after that, we went out, and we looked around the camp, and we seen another giant, 6'7", Weary Dunlop. Well, Weary was a marvellous man, the greatest of them all. The things that man did is hard to believe, but Weary done it all. He worked day and night trying to save lives, which were at its worst. We went from Java to Singapore and then onto the Burma line. We worked and slaved and toiled for what? No one would ever know. Because every day there's a flogging, and flogging at its worst. And we had two Japanese. You must pardon my expression, but one was Parson Bill and the other one was Lizard. And their eyes used to light up with glee when they were flogging anyone. So, when you're getting flogged, it's not so bad. But it's when you're watching someone else, it makes you really mad. And I said to my mate, well, when it's over, we'll cut out Bill's heart and we'll give it to the Lizard and he can eat it. And after that was over, we were going to stick a bayonet in his belly, take an intestine out through the hole and tie it to a tree, and then let him run until he pulled everything he's got inside out before we eventually finished him. So this Ronald Ramsey Ray used to sing a song over and over again. I think he must have been trying to tell us something.
Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Buddy, can you spare a dime?
He must have known that we had a railway line to build. Well, we built it, and they made it run. And they definitely made it race against time. Because you could go out early in the morning and come back late at night. So people that think of the ex-prisoners of war and what they have been, I've even heard people saying it was just a rest camp. Well, I don't think it was. But if anyone ever hears of this, they might know exactly what some people went through. Where they lived or died to save our country. The greatest country on earth. But people don't seem to realize exactly what it was like. I think they might have thought it was a rest camp. But a lot of fellas, this is just part of what I've been through. But a lot of fellas have done exactly the same thing. Many of them died. We were sent to one camp one day. We had to take up some cattle. And taking cattle through the jungle is no mean feat, because they can hardly stand on their feet. Going through swamps, slush, slipping over and falling down. And then some would run into the jungle. You run into after them. One day, two of us run into get a cow or this sort of water buffalo. But we struck a real wild one. By Jove, we could run. He chases out. When the two of us went in, I said, gee, this one's very big. And when he turned his head around, he came like a train.
We were in front of him. I think that day we could have raced a bullet. Then I charged into the middle of the heap of cows we had, or the herd of cows, I should say. And he just walked on till we got up to the camp. And on our way back, there was hundreds of skeletons along the way. They die of cholera when the cholera season's on. They die by the hundreds of thousands right along that track. So I picked them up and hung them up on the bamboos. They swayed and danced, especially the ones that's just been dead. They're not very long dead when the buzzards pick them clean. And I suppose the column and everything's still intact. And they bounce up and down. Well, the Japs, they were very frightened of the skeletons. They didn't mind killing people, but they didn't like skeletons. They run into the jungle to get round them by the time we'd got back. But in all our fun and pleasure, all on the way back on that track, one chap had actually seen me hanging them up. And I paid for that. Well, it's a funny thing, but through the camp and funny things had happened. One day, we had to clean up a camp. But in this camp, the Japanese sergeant major had been stealing tins of fish. And he got us in to clean up the camp when he knew there were going to be a big search. And sure enough, the 13 of us were taken in and had to clean the place up. I was the sergeant, 12 men.
And when I looked through the camp, I seen this Japanese sitting on a case, watching everyone. And I told the boys, when I looked down, each man had a tin of fish in his lap. See, in the jungle, or everywhere we went, you had no clothes. And all you had was this little lap. Well, after about 5 minutes, we went out. The boys hid the fish, and I told them that he was sitting watching them. Anyhow, sure enough, there was a search. The boys had hid their fish, and the officer told me I'd stole 600 tins of fish. I told him that I'd only stole the 13 tins. And as it turned out, no one had eaten a tin of fish. They had them all planted in the jungle. So we had to be beheaded. And I told the Japanese officer that I was the one that stole the fish. And he came to the agreement that I'd be the only one that would be beheaded. So the boys brought the tins of fish back into the camp and put them down. And I told the officer, there was the tins of fish. I told me mates where to get them, and they'd gone and got them. So he brought in the sergeant major, and he spoke in Japanese. I could understand a few things, but the interpreter was standing there, and I told him that I'd only stole the 13 tins of fish. This went on for a couple of days, but then the sergeant major didn't want only one to be beheaded. He wanted the 13 men to be beheaded. So he told the Japanese officer that I didn't steal the fish, it was the other men that stole the fish. And the interpreter told me what he'd said, and I said, that can't be true. I said, he was sitting in a box watching me steal those fish. But the interpreter told me that he hadn't been there, that he didn't know what happened. This was early in the piece. And I said, well, how did he know that the other men stole the fish? And of course they started then. This was on the third day, and I was taken out. And I was released and presented with 13 tins of fish. Well, I've never liked tin fish in all my life. So I took the fish out to the boys. I said, there's your fish, lads. And they said, no, we'll give them to the sick. So the sick got those fish. That's another part of the story. Another part is, mate and I, we went for about 7 miles to a native camp, and we sold Weary Dunlop's watch, my watch, and fountain pen, and ring, and got eggs for the sick. We brought them back through that jungle, down the mountainside, slipping and sliding, thunder and lightning, rain, and skating down the mountainside. We got back to that camp and we didn't break an egg. So the sick finished up with about another 300 eggs, unbroken. One time, we were out on the railway line. We came back one night. We seen the dirt getting thrown up in the air. And I walked over and I looked down this great big hole. And you guessed it, Weary was standing there with a shovel in his hand. And I said, what are you doing down there, Weary? And he said, and Weary, if you ever listen to this and happen to hear it, you'll remember these words. They call me a doctor. A Latrine, doctor, will I say? That wasn't your words. But you'll know exactly what you did say. Now, there's a man that, by rights, when we came home from the railway line, we should have been down digging that latrine, not weary. But that was just the type of man he was. We didn't know he was known as Christ the River by the English lads further up the line. And they moved into our camp one day, and one said, "Who's this Christ the River you've got here? We'd never ever heard of him." So he said, "He's a colonel." And we all chimed, "That must be Weary Dunlop you're talking about." And he said, "He's 6'7". And I said, "Yes, well, all you've got to do is look over there, mate." I said, "You're looking at him. The greatest man on earth." You could say lots of things about Weary. He was the greatest of the lot. And everything he ever done was all for the men. And even to this day, I think, if anything should ever want any help, I think the men would practically murder anyone to even look sideways at him. And it's a silly thing to say, that is really true. And that's the type of man he is. Sir Edward Dunlop. Well, after the work's all over and the railway line is finished, we've got to go back. That is the ones that's pit. And when I say fit, anyone was able to stand on his feet was fit. You were going back to Japan. They put us on two-thirds of a ship. The front had been blown clean away. And they welded on a great big plate across the front. And we sailed in the wake of another ship to Japan. Well, after a few days out, you're on this hell ship, as everyone called it. But we're heading for Japan. One day when I was up on top and looking over the side, I seen a great big tin fish go right underneath the stern of the ship. So I watched it go and was heading for the middle of another ship about a couple hundred yards away. Well, it hit a dead center and it split in half. That ship went straight to the bottom. Not one survivor left. They were all Japanese. And that's how we got rid of one. The next one went in a typhoon. And then we got to Japan. But I think we went right round the islands before we eventually got to Japan. We finished up going to Osaka, and that was down the copper mines, where when you first get to camp, you see for the first time how the Japanese really lived. That's a Japanese soldier I'm talking about. They have a bed about 7 foot long and about 100 feet in length, 18 inches of solid concrete, and that's where you slept. In the morning, when you go to work, they get out the fire hose and they just hose everything down to keep clean. Well, when you get home, it's usually nice and damp. And it's not too bad in the summer, but then when the winter came, it's very, very cold because you've got one blanket. That's to wrap yourself in. My mate and I used to sleep with my blanket on the concrete block, which is like a morgue, big slab, one over the top of us. But you went to work, you worked down the mine, worked from daylight till dark. The Japanese are allowed to go up and worship the sun. If you're working, say, 3 or 4 or 5 shifts straight in a row, the Japs are allowed to get up early in the morning and just on sundown. Then they come back and they work. You fill trolleys up with copper ore and pull them out. Some landings where things are busy, they put it down a hole. And at times those holes block up and you've got to go in, light a few sticks of jelly and blow them to clear the hole out, you see. Then you pick up the copper ore and you dump it in the truck and push it up till it meets the train further up the track. But now one day my mate and I told to get in the hole because I was the smallest. So we lit the fuse and explosion further up the line sent all this rock tumbling down behind my legs and I couldn't get out. I was caught by the right leg right up to my knee. And the mate tried to pull me out because I couldn't reach the fuse. It was about 4 or 5 feet away from my hand. And he couldn't get in through the hole to get to the fuse. So we couldn't find anything to cut the leg off. And I told him to get out of the way because it wouldn't be long before there'd be a bit of a blast. And I'd be on my way. And he said, well, I'm going to stick around, mate. So he pulled and heaved and tugged, and all of a sudden there was another explosion a little bit up the track. And while he was pulling me, the rock must have moved around my leg, and he pulled me right out just as the blast went off. We got showered with copper ore, but at least I still had my leg. And I thanked me mate, and I told him that had been the other way, I think I'd have been leaving him there. But nevertheless, that's how it goes, I suppose. So it's good to have a good, really good mate.